Welcome to another edition of Decentralizing AI. We're here to talk about AI and the intersections with both engineering, mysticism, philosophy, politics, all of the above.
All the ways AI can fix the world we live in.
Exactly, which are numerous, perhaps infinite, in fact.
There's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, so we just got a new model drop yesterday, Opus 4.8.
Yep, I've been playing with it quite a bit.
Yeah.
Ultra code.
Although, hello from the past, because this is surely going to come out, you know, further along than when the actual model dropped, but hopefully not too stale.
Yeah.
So, but and then there's also this ultra code feature that you've been playing with, right?
Yeah, in dynamic workflows.
Yeah.
Which I need to dive into it deeper. But I've been using it, and it's pretty cool to compare it to this other agentic coding workflow that I've been working on. So there's a library that came out at the end of December originally called Oh My Open Code. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it is a lot of prompts and configurations for running different models for different types of coding work, like planning and reviewing and doing actual coding once the plan is well defined. And what's very cool is it's a very I think it's Greek themed, like Sisyphus is the main agent, and so it's got these like notions of like one is the main orchestration, and it will just keep running and will not stop running. Uh-huh. And so it originally started as Oh My Open Code. They've renamed to Oh My Open Agent. I think that makes sense. It's very agentic. And now there's versions for, there's an Oh My Claude Code and an Oh My Codex one, I think, and maybe even one for Gemini. They're like different repos. They're not even like fully synced. Anyway, so just, you know, you might have to like look, poke around a bit.
Right.
But I've been playing with Oh My Claude Code, and it's got some of these features one thing that's really cool is this CCG planning command.
Okay.
CCG Claude Codex Gemini. So if you have Codex and Gemini in your machine, when you do a plan, Claude will actually farm out planning tasks to Codex and Gemini and then get their thoughts and feedback. It's very interesting to watch. And then Claude will be the tiebreaker and make the final decision. And I've already found that to be deeper than some of the other planning, because Codex will surface some things but miss others. Same with Gemini. And it's never the same. They're never the same. Come up with the same plan.
And does it do that all within a single harness? Or is it?
So from my perspective, I launch Claude Code and then I type /CCG and a thing. And then Claude does everything. And then when those agents are done and come back, Claude will synthesize and tell me, like even give me a little table, what Codex did, what Gemini did, and, you know, go from there. And so that's just what, I think there's like 30 commands you get if you install Oh My Claude Code. So, but anyway, so there's this thing where, so you can do these like major epic plans, and you can like ultra, there's like hyper plan where like it'll spin up 5 agents to tear that plan apart. Uh-oh. And be really critical. So you can spend like as much time as you want planning. And then when it comes to doing the work, there's like this agent that will farm off teams. So I've been playing, you know, there's one piece of there's this piece of middleware I need to build for some stuff that we're doing at Delegance. And it's like an important thing. It'll touch a lot of stuff. It's mostly like a piece of accounting software to like keep track of limits and budgets and, let people create like sub-accounts, let agents create sub-accounts. So, you know, I did the planning, came up with like, it's about a 1300 line plan. It's like broken up into like 8 phases. Right. And so I've been testing different agentic workflows and being able to like one shot the whole thing. And what's interesting is that like the default Oh My Claude Code setup, you basically run out of context. So I've been tweaking this new skill I've been working on called Marathon, where essentially it is like even one level up higher. So it'll basically create a team of agents for every phase of the plan. Mm-hmm. And Well, so to be clear, there's like a super high level agent. Then there is an orchestration agent per phase. And that orchestration agent per phase then launches a team to work on that phase. So mostly just a managed context. But then the idea is that that just keeps going and going, and you can like let it run. You know, it would run for like 2 or 3 hours, and then I'd come back. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to see if it, because like you spend so much time planning, a lot of the stuff gets figured out. I should be able to like one shot it, especially if it's, it depends on the software you need, right? Like for some things where you need a lot of functionality to be working, but if it's not directly dealing with money or very sensitive data or like cryptography, you know, maybe it's okay for it to all the tests pass, but it's, I don't know, there's inefficiencies or whatever, you know, there's different requirements on software. So for a lot of things, maybe you just want to make a crazy deep plan, try to one-shot it, see how well it works. And so what's cool is, so I made this marathon skill like last week, and I've been like playing with it, and it was a step up. So it could go much farther, because before, if I didn't have it, I would run it. I like by the second or third phase of this plan, it would break. But with this marathon skill, it got all the way to like the last phase. It turned out the last phase was just too much work and too unspecified. So even the orchestration agent and team kind of failed. It was basically too much scoped work.
And what does that failure look like exactly?
You know, the agents all correctly identified problems that they could not solve, and they basically surfaced those blockers up. But there was no mechanism to repair or like redo it or like have a loop. So it just kind of, it kind of caught the right errors. It stopped, it surfaced it back up, but then there was nothing to like mitigate that and keep going.
I see.
But what's wild is that now yesterday, Opus 4.8 came out. There's this Ultra Code. Ultra Code looks like it has a lot of the same functionality. Right. So I actually even gave Ultra Code this task this morning, and it did build the whole thing without failing. So
wow,
it is really cool. And I think, again, the biggest thing here is just context, because so I didn't play with /goal enough. And I know that's been the last couple of weeks I think Codex 2 has had something like this, but you give it a goal, like keep running until tests pass.
It's like the built-in Ralph loop,
right,
that people were kind of hacking together previously. Now there's like a first class primitive for that,
right? But I don't know, I was asking Claude, like, compare that with this marathon skill versus Ultra Code. Like, if that worked, why even do Ultra Code? I think there was context limit issues with /goal, where like if you needed more than like a million token context window, it wouldn't do very well. Because otherwise, just principally, why even make these dynamic workflows in Ultra Code mode?
Well, what about parallelism? Because it's not just, you know, context running out, but you could be dividing a task into multiple parts and research loops, review loops, and they can all be happening in parallel. Whereas if you just have a single instance running and it will keep running and chasing after the goal till it ends, but it can't divide up and, you know, branch the work and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think there's like both of those benefits you would get.
And then also, you know, I think one thing about context is even if you have like a really big context window and you have enough room to put everything in it, the quality of the output can degrade as it starts to fill up.
So it's funny you say this. Someone on my team was asking me, he's been letting his jobs get to like 70, 80, 90% context window filled in Claude Code, which with the default model is 1 million. And then I told him, I was like, I personally don't, if it starts going above 300K, because I have the verbose setting toggled on, so I can see how many tokens are in the current conversation in Claude Code. And so I'm a hard numbers person for this at least.
Yeah.
So I watch it, and if it starts to get to 300K, I'm like, okay, let's see how this goes. If it gets 400K, I'm like, all right, we got to wrap up and move on. Even though technically that's 40% of the 1 million.
Right. Yeah. I mean, And something I've been experimenting with or noticed anecdotally, and maybe this is not real, like I haven't rigorously measured it, but I feel like when a context window is exclusively devoted to a certain role or a certain level of abstraction, rather than it playing multiple roles. I mean, even like if I have an AI agent implementing code, I would never, like, within that same context window, ask it to review the code it just wrote. I always feel like I get better quality review if I instantiate a brand new context window, a brand new session, and say, you're the reviewer. Or even sometimes when I'm building tools for an agent, like I'll have an agent build a CLI, and the CLI is not for me to use. The CLI is for another agent to use. So the user testing, it's not really relevant, like what I think of the ergonomics and the experience of using the tool. I want to ask the other agent that's going to consume the tool to do user testing. But if I ask the agent that built the CLI to user test its own tool, I actually don't get as good results if I hand it to a separate context window and I say, hey, we just built this tool. Can you test it? And so I really like to have context windows locked to roles, levels of metacognition, levels of abstraction. So I'll have a meta agent and I make sure that its context window is always at the bird's eye view of what's going on. And then I'll have an implementation agent and its only task is to implement. And I'll have a review agent and its only role is to review. And that separation feels really nice and clean, rather than just having, like, even if you assume like an infinite context window and ask, and, you know, loading it up with all these different ways of thinking about the problem or tasks or roles, I think you don't get as good quality when you kind of separate it out like that.
I mean, it feels like it's similar with humans. Like, right. You know, I mean, it sounds like you're just making the job easier. You're making the instructions more clear. And I mean, it sounds like you're scoping the work for the agents. And exactly. We see how important that is with engineering teams and humans. And
yeah. And, you know, I could get fancier where there's like a different system prompt or Claude MD that helps more firmly define the identity of those different context windows. And I think, like, what is it true that, like, what is like loaded in at the beginning of the context window has a disproportionate impact?
What I've heard, it might depend per model, but that and at the end. I think the end and the beginning are both weighted higher.
Interesting.
Which I kind of feel like is maybe not even that surprising from just training over the data and examples, because usually at the end, you're concisely saying what you want or don't want.
Right.
And at the beginning, you're kind of giving the broader context. Like,
sure.
You kind of are like starting fresh or more, you know, you don't just start in the middle of like a brain dump. And so I have seen that. And then getting back to the context window, what you're talking about as well, you know, there's a very big, you know, this has been true for a while, like years now. I mean, I say years, it hasn't been that long since we're in this phase of AI, since ChatGPT came out and we've had large language models, but still, it's been at least like, I think the last few years, it's been known that, okay, sure, you can say that a context window for a model is whatever you want it to be, or whatever you can functionally get it to the model to, like, or the model or the I don't know what they call it, the inference time. I'm probably using the wrong word here, but whatever it, like OLAMA or VLLM, the thing that like loads the model.
Right.
So you can, there's a lot of techniques to even, you know, and even like when they release models, they'll say this model supports this context window, but there's techniques you can do where you can enlarge that model. You could search the literature. There's a lot of techniques to literally do this. You can make it as big as you want, but the problem is okay, sure, you can put as much as you want in, and okay, it won't crash. It'll give you some tokens out. But whether those tokens are any use is a whole other story. So it's accuracy per how much context you can actually operate in.
Right.
So they do these like, and there's like these benchmarks they do, like needle in a haystack. There's like a phrase or a word you want the model to find out of a massive amount of context. And they measure this with like, you know, 10% of a context window, 20%, 30%. And, you know, a lot of people have found, I think once you get to, I think with the recent generation of Claude models, like 400, 500K tokens, you start to really like drop off in terms of some accuracy.
Mm.
Now, it also depends on the kind of work you're doing. A lot of times your work might not be needle in the haystack. Right. You can go up to, I mean, yesterday, they keep doing all these like optimizations, right? So not like when I went to go switch from Opus 4.7 to 4.8 when it came out,
mm-hmm.
and I tried to switch like in the middle of a long conversation.
Right.
It warned me like a lot of these tokens had been cached.
Sure.
They might have to be like recached or something. I might use it in my usage.
Well.
Yeah. And then there's been like innovations in compacting.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those can help. So it's becoming a much more nuanced picture.
Right.
Because how you compact and I'm not sure if prompt caching necessarily affects the context length that you can, you know, actionably get good results from.
I think it's more about the cost than the quality with caching.
Got it.
It's
okay.
Like, and the speed. But I think the Anthropic warning is more like, hey, you're going to pay extra.
Yeah.
Because we got to resubmit this entire context window and, you know, run inference over it. And so be aware that it might surprise you the token usage you're doing when you perform that action.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's interesting because it's almost like a context window is like a story, you know? Like, I mean, these LLMs, they're next word predictors.
Yeah.
Right? And so you're setting up the body of the text and then you're saying, predict what comes next. And so if you have a very coherent story, then it would make sense that its ability to predict the story you're trying to tell, like if you set up the story in the right way and you want it to have a certain kind of ending, I mean, you want the ending to be the most beautiful code or solution. Like that's the surprise ending. It's like, oh man, you know, we had this problem and it's complicated. And then look at this incredible solution. Look at this incredible plan. And it's easier for it to predict the story you're trying to tell if you have a high degree of coherence and structure and intention in the corpus of text that it has to infer from and try to predict where you want to go with this, where do you want it to end up? And every single token in that context window is affecting what it's going to end up predicting, what its output is going to be. And that's why, you know, I think a lot of times, like, you can get really stuck in a bad story where it's not going well and then you can't get it back on track. It keeps not going well. That's something we've talked about
a few times
in the past.
Well, they even have that flag that if the user starts getting upset or angry, and that alone can start degrading performance.
Exactly, because that's part of the story you're telling. And in a way, you're telling the model, this is a story about things crashing and burning. So the next token should be failure.
You know, the other thing is, and there's a really great term for this, and I don't remember off the top of my head, but oftentimes, if you don't want a model to have a certain kind of behavior, saying do not do X in the prompt is worse than just leaving it out completely. Because saying do not do this is almost right. Like encouraging the model, or it's like increases the probability of it doing that undesired behavior because you've named it or explicitly.
It's like, do not press the red button.
Yeah. Right. Well, and now it knows
you're gonna, like, humans will then press it.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, oh my God, I can't, like, I must press it because I was told not to. So,
right. Right.
Yeah. So it's everything you do has a hidden instruction. There's the explicit conscious level instruction, and then there's the shadow unconscious instruction. And that's the more subtle part that can be harder to notice. You know, I told the model it did the wrong thing. Why isn't it listening? And it's like, well, what is the hidden instruction that you're telling it when you issue it those commands? And you're telling it, this is a story about dysfunctional collaboration. Please predict how this dysfunction usually plays out.
Sounds like we need / therapist to get in the terminal with us right there. Be like, hey, Dustin, I know you want this feature, but you are not communicating well.
Absolutely.
And it's no surprise Claude is not following your instructions. Like,
yeah. I mean, I have a skill called check-in that is sort of like the therapist's skill. You know, we're going to do a check-in. You know, we're going to kind of apply techniques from therapy and psychoanalysis. And then that becomes part of the story. It becomes part of the pattern, becomes part of the statistical associations of, even when things are going bad, we see in the text, when language shifts in this way, then if we're going to predict what happens next in the story, like if you're watching a movie and people are having an argument and people are having a fight and you're like, what's going to happen next? You know, is like, well, maybe the, you know, something's going to get smashed. You know, that's where this is usually like, you feel it building the tension. Like, I can predict where this is going. I can see where this is going, you know? But then in the movie, if there's like some intervention or somebody like, you know, pauses and apologizes and you're like, okay, now predict what's going to happen next. And you're like, well, probably going to reconcile, you know? So that's, everything is just storytelling, and these are language machines, and they're just trying to predict what happens next in the story.
You know, we've talked a lot about naming things and making things explicit and trying to get, well, I mean, especially you've been bringing up all these amazing points on past episodes. You know, this is something I've been thinking a lot about. So, okay, these models are largely trained in such a way to follow instructions, right? You ask for something in the prompt, and the model follows that is trained to follow the instructions. Okay, so because I'm like thinking through some of the longer term repercussions and trends for models and like on the road to AGI. So it sounds like. And really, if AGI in the future will be of the same form as these large language models now, which I'm not so sure they will be. Mm-hmm. I think the models we have now will help us build the next generation.
Right.
But I don't necessarily think. I think they're going to look so different than what we have today.
Uh huh.
Okay, because if you had a model that was big enough and powerful enough and could perfectly follow instructions,
mm-hmm.
would you ever need any other model? Would you ever need to fine-tune a model?
Well, I mean, the thing is, oftentimes, the most important thing a collaborator can do is not follow your instructions.
I actually worked on Rebel Agents like 6-7 years ago. There's a lot of actually, you might, it sounds, first of all, if you put Rebel Agents in a talk title that you give somewhere, you get 4 times the number of people will show up.
I mean, it sounds enticing. Let's
but
go.
there's a lot of situations where obviously you want an AI to not do what you ask.
Yes.
It might have information that, like, you, like, the one of the simplest examples is a robot is helping you carry something heavy. Mm-hmm. You're walking backwards. The robot is walking forwards. And a robot sees something behind you and is like, stop, you're going to trip and fall over it. And you didn't tell it. You told it to help you carry this box to this destination. And now it's telling you to stop. It sounds very like harmless, but that information asymmetry is something that these AI systems can have. And so you absolutely should have that.
I mean, this is also kind of the problem of sycophancy or AI psychosis, where the AI is happy to accelerate your descent into madness and not push back. And
say, it's got to follow instructions.
Yeah, this is where you want to go. Let's go. You know, this is what you want to believe. Let's, you know, add fuel to the fire of whatever insane thing you're thinking of without, you know, whereas a human would be like, hey, hold on a second. I don't know about this.
Are we role playing or is this your real life you're talking about?
Well, it blurs, you know, but, or so also in a business context, you know, there's the problem of groupthink, you know, or a yes man, you know, the boss or the CEO has some stupid idea and everybody is just like, yes, sir, this is great. You're a genius. We love it. And the whole thing flops. And, you know, the person who raises their hand and is like, I don't know about that. You know, maybe this isn't going to work. And, you know, let's question this assumption. Let's, you know, try to persuade me, try to convince me. Let's have a debate about it back and forth. Like, that is where you get the highest quality decision making, thinking is that sort of adversarial dynamic or a dialectical dynamic where thought can get interrupted. And in fact, I think, right, in the state of AI today, that is the primary role for the human, because the AI doesn't do that. The AI doesn't or rarely interrupts itself or interrupts the direction you've given. And so you have to play that role. You have to come in and say, well, is this the right thing? Or maybe I thought this is what I wanted, but is it? And that kind of critical reflection and question making, I think, is, you know, in a way, that's what makes me a little bit hesitant about some of these Ralph loops and workflows where it just spins up a bunch of agent and just races all to the end, because I'm thinking, well, I need to be able to come in and intervene and pose that question and say, actually, let's not waste, you know, 10 million tokens going into this direction. Let's pause, reflect, and maybe we need to start over. Maybe we need to rethink things. Maybe we need to switch. And that is the kind of AI that I would love to work with, is an AI that puts me into question and pushes back and doesn't follow instructions, but thinks about what is the deepest meaning and the deepest potential of what we're doing, and can actually relate the instruction back to something more fundamental.
In addition to that, I wonder, can you put everything into instructions? This is where, like bringing a little bit back to this question of, like, would fine-tuning models as a thing that we do die? Like, would there be this one model? And what I realized is there might be some behaviors that you want from a model, some outputs that you want, that you could never get from giving an instruction. So it's almost because like the fine tuning, well, any kind of any part of the training process, pre-training, post-training, is about extracting patterns, whatever they may be, if they're hidden or whatnot, not necessarily made explicit, from underlying data. And it reminds me that there is, again, I need to find the reference for this, but I believe there is, if I butcher this, don't crucify me on this. But there's some kind of a, I don't know if it's Japanese, some kind of Asian tradition, I think, of someone who is able to look at a like a chicken egg and tell, a human can look at it and tell whether it's going to be a male or a female. But they cannot put it into words. But they can teach it. So they can teach another human by like trial and error, and the human will like guess or not guess. And they can never describe it, but it's like a feeling or an intuition that you can develop to tell whether or not a chicken egg is going to be a male or a female. And that makes me wonder, is there a similar thing happening here? Are there certain, like, and this could be, for example, with like style of speaking, maybe. So this is something that I think is still not solved, which is, let's say I want a model to talk like, or to write like me, like in my voice and my tone and the way. And you can imagine trying to give this via a prompt and many examples, but maybe, and it'd be wild to try and prove this like at a formal level, but maybe it is impossible at the explicit like character token level that this is only something where, you know, after having so many hours of conversations with you and collecting all of that data, that the pattern could be learned. And so then if this is the case, then maybe AGI will never be a single model. Maybe there will always be, you know, maybe an infinite number or an infinitely growing set of fine-tuned models depending on behaviors and other things. And I think this has big ramifications for decentralizing AI and like placing bets on companies and frontier labs, and like maybe it's never, there will never be like a single model.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of reminds me of like a Gödel's incompleteness theorem, or I think Max was talking about on another episode we had, like you can't have a set that includes all sets, and you can prove that mathematically that that can't exist. And I think a lot of what we've discovered in math shows that this dream of some kind of universal, complete, total system where we don't need anything else and it can encompass all things, though that doesn't really exist.
It's also like if the act of specializing might literally mean you get better at one thing and you get worse at another. And so it's all just, oh, this is also just kind of like human history, like human civilization has flourished because humans have specialized.
Right.
And that's enabled one person to do something way better than a bunch of people doing it average. Like agriculture is the famous example here. Like guns, germs, and steel. This is one of the main premises of this book. Uh-huh. This idea that like you get more advancements in innovation and greater technology in a society where everyone specializes. And then one person can grow the food for 1,000 people rather than everyone spending most of their time kind of poorly getting food.
Right. Like division of labor.
Like division of labor.
You know?
Yeah.
And
but the act of specializing might literally mean that you cannot do there's maybe more things you can't do. You're worse at other things. And so,
yeah, I mean, it's certain phenomenologists have described consciousness this way, which is inherent to become aware of something is to become unaware of other things. Like you bring something into focus and then the background blurs. And that's what it means to have something in your attention. It means to take other things out of your attention.
So then it's like, depending on the type of work, like this means there's going to be like a Cambrian explosion of agents. Like we are at the tiniest, earliest day. I mean, there'll be, forget billions. We'll have like trillions. Whatever comes after, what comes after trillion?
Quadrillion?
Quadrillion. We'll have quadrillion. There'll be one agent for every sat.
I mean, we're already kind of seeing this in how at least AI is playing out right now. You know, I mean, I code with, you know, there's a lot of debates about I mean, you were just saying you're using both Claude and Codex and Gemini at the same time, you know? And then even within the harnesses, they have smaller models that are doing summarization, or they might have a model that is specific to memory tools, fine tuning. You know, there's a memory system called Honcho where they have a model specifically tuned for memory tooling. And so having multiple models or diversity of models, I mean, we see that with, you know, in biology, genetic diversity leads to the most resiliency or the most interesting kind of and most successfully performing organisms are produced out of genetic diversity. Or even when we were talking about the structure of thought, where if you have two sides of the argument or the steel man, or seeing it, you know, testing things, pushing back against it, there isn't just this like universal God's eye view perspective we can impose on things to get the highest quality outputs. We need this kind of dynamic tension and this creative tension where things are built up and then destroyed, and it goes through these different phases of things. And so, yeah, I would kind of expect that to continue with AI. The other thing that's a little bit tangential that reminds me of is, you know, there's all this fear about, you know, what AI is so, it's going to automate so much and it's so intelligent that it's going to get rid of all the jobs. And isn't that like a huge crisis? But if you wanted to have the most jobs ever, the best thing to do would be to make division of labor illegal.
Go on.
Because imagine how inefficient everything would be. Like another, really the argument against AI is an argument against efficiency. If we're too efficient at our work, if the economy is too efficient, then we won't need as many people, right? And so
yeah,
the converse is true. If things were really inefficient, you would need way more people. And so it kind of brings out the absurdity of what's being argued there. It's like the efficiency is the goal, not jobs. Jobs are a means to an end, not an end in itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have a moral imperative to reduce the cost of things. And there's if all these predictions about AI are true, as long as the market is free enough that competitive dynamics continue and there isn't some kind of like monopoly, I can't imagine how the cost of things won't plummet. And there's this stuff about like, you know, if we wanted everybody in the world to have the same standard of living of like a middle-class American, we would need like six Earths or something like that. And so it's really... by bringing the cost of things down, we need less material things. We need less earths to sustain a high quality standard of living. And that should be the objective, because otherwise it's an argument for putting more people into poverty to create more jobs, which is kind of an absurd place to be in.
I think one reason why practically this is maybe hard for some people to relate to is because, unfortunately, with many things, the cost has not gone down over time, right? The promise of technology is you make something more efficient, it's cheaper to produce, which then means like we should be working less hours, like quality of life. And this is where, you know, I think a lot of the Bitcoiner thesis kind of plays out, where like inflation is one of the forces that has prevented this from happening.
I think it has slowed it down, but like if you look at the state of the average person 100 years ago or 200 years ago, like the cost of living has gone down. People are working less hours. And you know, things that only the nobility would have or the aristocracy would have, like now a lot of people have. And so
it's a good point, especially TVs. TVs have really...
TVs, refrigerators, you know, the kind of food we get access to. I mean, it used to be people work 100 hours a week in the field, you know, or in the factory. Like, it was pretty bleak. You know, I think a lot of times we judge the current day based upon some perfect state. But when you judge it on a curve, when you say, like, how are things today compared to 200 years ago, or let alone, I mean, think about living in 1500 or something.
Yeah,
like,
wow.
You know, the state of sanitation, everything like smelled. And,
before soap? That'd be rough.
I mean, it seems awful. Like, just daily life and people, the lifespan was a lot shorter. And so I think that there's a lot of like rhetoric and propaganda because people are trying to find enemies, or they're trying to channel like feelings of resentment to gain political power. And there's a simplification about the way economics works.
Also, if you want to get followers on social media, if your content is like rage baiting and forces people to have emotions, they're going to pay more attention. And
yeah, exactly. So, but I think there's, when you look at the actual data, it shows that a lot of what's happening, a lot of these systems of capitalism and economics and technology and efficiency is working. And it doesn't mean it's perfect and it doesn't have some fundamental flaws. But, you know, that is something I think we want to continue, because otherwise there simply isn't like enough, because the other illusion people have is there's enough food in the world, there's enough houses in the world, there's enough for everybody. And the problem is somebody's hoarding it all. And if we could just kind of like distribute it, it would be enough for everyone.
Yeah, but I think that's popular.
A lot of people think that. But I don't think that that's true. Like, if we just stopped with the state of supply right now, there wouldn't be enough for everyone, you know? I mean, certainly certain things are inherently scarce, like only so many people can live on the beach.
Sure.
You know, I mean, AI is not going to solve that.
yeah.
Or maybe well,
many islands. We're going to have a lot of islands popping up.
Or if we go to other planets or something like that. But
did you see I just saw this tidbit, but so I think they're preparing for the SpaceX IPO.
Yes.
And this is like a source of a source, but it was like one of these newsletters I get. It said that Elon Musk's package for like the bonus he would get as CEO of SpaceX is tied to this deliverable of having 1 million people on Mars.
Wow.
So in a couple of years there might be a lot of traffic in space.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the objective, you know. And of course, even if that happens, people are going to say, you know, it should get clawed back, and you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it is important to try to keep things going, to have enough hope in the future that we want to continue to invest in new ideas. I mean, a lot of people think we shouldn't even be trying to go into space at all, you know, or it's a complete waste of resources. Let's just focus on what's on this planet and that kind of thinking. But I think there's a lot of fear and sort of a scarcity mindset that underlies those points of view. And a lot of that gets fed into what's happening with AI, where, you know, there's the fear of what can go wrong, and then there's the hope of what can be made better by it. And, you know, we give up being able to unlock new benefits to the world if we're so afraid of what might happen, and we just stop here. And I don't think it's good enough to stop where things are right now. You know, because there's too many people in the world that don't have enough, and there's too many people in the world that are suffering. And, you know, we need to continue to try to develop better and better solutions so more and more people can have a higher quality of life. And but the argument's usually framed in the other way, that because people are suffering, we should shut all this stuff down, you know? And there's similar like arguments about the data centers, where it's like, oh, the data centers are consuming all the water. But actually, they consume a fraction of water that an almond farm does, or a golf course does. But you don't see legislation to ban golf courses or almond farms, or people protesting that those things shouldn't be built.
The other thing is, I think one of the biggest sources of like high cost of goods is the cost of distributing them. And I think the cost of distributing them is largely an energy problem. Mm-hmm. So better developments in batteries and grid technology and being able to have better energy would literally be one of the most important driving factors to like your groceries being cheaper and like other things being cheap, maybe construction being cheaper and things like that. So that's one of those other things where you know, it feels weird to be kind of anti-producing more energy.
Right. And I mean, it's an input into everything.
Yeah. And literally just yourself, right? Like if you eat higher quality foods and enough calories, you're able to do more like day to day and function better.
I mean, I heard somebody make the argument where they said that, you know, when people get, when they are raised out of poverty or they get more money, they're less happy because then they have these jealousies or they are more focused on material things. And you can really quickly get into this like twisted perspective of like, well, therefore we should like put more people in poverty so they can be happier. You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, yeah. It's like, yeah, it's not like material things don't create new problems, but like all things being equal, like I'd rather not be starving versus be starving.
I had a family member that used to tell me this quote. Money doesn't buy happiness. Poverty doesn't buy anything.
That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, and I think a lot of these arguments also come down to kind of your view of human nature and whether you think people are fundamentally good or fundamentally bad.
I think it comes down to that so much.
Like this has been a big thing in political theory for a long time. Like Thomas Hobbes had this view of the state of nature, which is basically this thought experiment about what society is like before any sort of government or law. And his view, which I think is very predominant today, is that in the state of nature, life is nasty, brutish, and short, is what he said, and that it's a war of all against all. And it's basically like hell. It's so bad that any government is preferable to no government. And so that legitimized the tyrant. When he said, you do not have, because it's like in, you know, 1500s or before that, and you have like a king and, you know, and they're trying to figure out like, is there some way we can intellectually justify the system? And we know sometimes the king just like arbitrarily orders somebody to be killed because he doesn't like them. And there's like, and he's not claiming like, oh, the king's always just and always does the right thing. He's saying it's bad. It's tyranny. But if you try to destabilize the system and you try to bring it down, the alternative is way worse. And so even if the king orders your death, you should just willingly allow yourself to be killed. And we would not have the American Revolution, democracy, a free society, or any of these things if it wasn't for the arguments advanced by Locke and Rousseau that was about rethinking the state of nature and actually saying the state of nature isn't that bad. And that there's natural law in the state of nature, there's natural compassion and empathy, and the actual constituted state can absolutely be worse than the state of nature. And that is what made it possible to justify the right of revolution, to say, if the state, the political system becomes worse than the state of nature, then we have a right and a duty to revolt, to overturn it. And so if you come to these conclusions that humans are so bad and freedom is so bad and all of this, like, you're essentially justifying North Korea, you're justifying tyranny, and you have to have some hope and belief in the goodness of people, even without being controlled, to even have the notion of freedom. And I think that same thing is taking place in these issues around AI, where people are so afraid of humanity that they think that everybody needs to be controlled by a small group. And people can't be trusted with leisure because they're just going to do drugs and they're going to do socially negative things. So they better be working all day at some menial job, because if they're just free to decide what they want to do with their lives, like, that's going to be the worst possible thing. Or, you know, all AI has to be controlled and censored, because if you give somebody the power of AI, they're going to do it for bad things. And of course, history shows us that that small group that you is supposed to be the ones that can hold all the power are corrupted by it, and they're the ones that end up being evil and doing the bad things, not just the common person or the average person. And so I think that's an important lens to take to these questions about how negative people are, including people who work at like these labs, like who are like up close to what's happening with AI. And so many of them are so pessimistic. But really what they're afraid of isn't AI. They're afraid of humanity.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just so many things to follow up on here. One thing that just keeps coming up for me is, you know, I think the relationship with yourself is very important. Do you love yourself? Have you ever told yourself, I love you? Have you ever looked yourself in the mirror, said, I love you? How do you feel about your family? Like, okay, it's one thing to talk about society or massive political groups, but like, what about your family? Like, what would you want for your family?
Right.
And in some ways, is not the whole world your family? Like, if you can broaden that scope, then, and you have that relationship with yourself, like someone who hates themselves,
right?
They might be projecting a lot of that. First of all, they might have a lot of negativity towards themselves or shame or like, and like, this is not, you see this in movies. This is like pop, this is like popular culture. Like you see so much, this is like a very well defined, like well-known role and stuff. And
right.
Like, how much is stemming from that? So it really does start with the individual and empowering yourself and like treating yourself like a best friend.
Right.
Treating you like, also understanding like you're a human, you're not like a machine. And then like, just think about the communities. Like, you know, you could like, I don't know, you like go to church or you go to some meetup or like you meet like, like if people were, there's also this idea that like violence itself has epidemic tendencies. So it's almost like there's some researchers, there's some like TED Talks on this, that they have shown that like when something violent happens, then you can almost even plot it on a map, like an epidemic, which is a sign. It's like one piece of evidence that like violence is not part of our like nature. And like people are, yeah, basically people are fundamentally good. And any negative emotion or behavior is coming out of like something, some problem or something. It's not like the default state of people.
Right.
And so what this means is that like, because I feel like a lot of people lose faith in like society or lose faith in their fellow neighbor or other people. And like, we have to get that back.
Right. And like you're saying, it's usually because they've lost faith in themselves. And then they're projecting that onto other people. And, you know, it reminds me of a couple things that Socrates said, or at least through Plato, which is he said that, you know, if you know what the right thing is, you do it. Right? Like when people do something bad or evil, it's due to ignorance. It's due because they don't understand what they're doing or the consequences or actions. If you understand the good thing, then you just naturally do the good thing because it's inherently good. Like it's kind of circular.
Well, and then is not everyone doing what they think is best at every moment?
Right. That's essentially what he's saying. And, you know, I mean, it gets complicated because there's definitely times where I've known something is wrong and I do it anyway. So, you know, that is, I think...
Sounds very human.
Yeah, like that's the thing that I think really starts to throw people for a loop where they're like, well, I don't know about that. But even that is like, it's an expression of pain or suffering or confusion or being overwhelmed or under duress. And so it's not like this lucid, conscious thing. And so I think, you know, that's never happened to me when I've been kind of in a balanced, clear state or like after meditation or something like that. And, you know, the hungrier you are, like when people are starving, they're more likely to like do violence, right? When you're under duress or if you're tired or if you're stressed out, you know, that's when people snap at somebody, you know, because they're stressed. And so that also shows that there's an inherent goodness, you know. And the other thing he said is that the soul or the psyche, you know, depending on how you want to look at it, is analogous to a city. It's not just a single thing. It's a political system. There's all these parts.
Your soul is a political system. That might be the title of this episode.
And
you're talking about the soul MD file I put in my open claw. That's
exactly.
I'm kidding. Sorry.
It is. Well, thinking of that as a political system would probably be an interesting way to structure it. But how you govern that political system determines the health of the soul. Like, are you governing it like a totalitarian dictatorship and there's some like oppressed minority? You know, that is getting excluded or left out or mistreated, or do you have like a political system where all the different parts are respected and have a place and are collaborating and working together? And so if there is some constituency in that city that is been branded as bad, and then you see that in somebody else, then you think they're bad or you're against them. And so like just to that point you're making where usually there's this relationship to when we reject somebody else or we judge somebody else, that it's coming from something that already happened in terms of the self. And then that's how we're seeing the other people around us. And so, you know, that feeds into the dynamics that are happening with AI, and AI also may be part of the solution out of this, because it can be this mirror to the soul and kind of help us see things in ourselves that we're blind to.
Yeah, we don't want to admit, or we don't, like, in some ways, what does it mean to be human? Isn't it being redefined now that we have this new kind of intelligence that we've never had before? And so we have a source of intelligence. Until now, the only thing, you know, at the level of intelligence that we know of is us as humans. And it's very interesting. There are already trade-offs with, like, these AI systems where you can see where for certain kinds of jobs or work or interactions, you would much rather have a human than an AI. Like, why is there all this pushback for, like, AI slop?
Right.
I mean, it's because it's, like, garbage, and you don't get that kind of garbage from humans. Like, humans don't put, you know, literally, it's like too expensive to produce. It's too expensive for a human to even produce that.
That's true.
So, but it's like that. Like, so in some ways, it's like the human premium is becoming more established. Like, the value of, like, being able to interact with a human is becoming a luxury now. Like, yeah. It's becoming a price. Like, you go on GitHub and you want a human to review your code, or you, like, go online and you want to interact with the human, or you call customer support and you want to interact with the human. Like, that's becoming a luxury. And, you know, it could be just because it's, like, you know, scarcity for that. But I think it's really starting to highlight what makes us special and unique and different, and maybe even provide a bigger space for things that, like, just more accepting of the full human experience.
Right, and being able to appreciate what is unique to us, and also things that we thought were unique to us that we're realizing aren't.
Or things that we think are, like, bad, as maybe just being, just having, like, a greater understanding that, like, there's, like, nothing is really good or bad.
Right.
Like, it's all...
It's a spectrum.
Well, in anything good, you can find something bad in it. And anything bad, you can find something good in it.
Right.
And a lot of bad decisions are made by labeling things as good and bad.
Right. I mean, that's the story of the Garden of Eden, right? Yeah. They eat from the tree of knowledge, and they know good and evil, and then that creates the fall. And so there's some kind of dualistic state of consciousness, some kind of dualism that disconnects us from God. And that also comes up in the Tao Te Ching, you know, where it says, you know, when the leader tries to control everything, everything falls apart. You know, when the master does nothing, the work is completed in perfection. It's like this whole play of opposites that when you try to focus on things. And I think that also is coming up in the AI debates, where it's like there's this presumption, like this with alignment, there's this presumption that we know what is good for humanity, and we just need to impose that on the AI, and also impose that on people from the top down. And we want to steer it and control it. And the fear is that we might lose control, that we may not be able to align it. We may not be able to steer it how we want. But in some ways, it's much better if we don't control it. Can't steer it.
If we get into this future where, like we were saying earlier, there's so many specialized agents, there's no single agent that dominates every other agent.
Exactly.
Then, you know, there's a better chance for, like, an ecosystem to emerge that has equilibrium and balance and
right
properties. And this is even, like, you know, if you rewatch The Matrix, I'm a huge fan of the series.
Love it.
I like all three movies. A lot of people hate movies 2 and 3. I like all of them.
Yeah. 2, I like. 3, I'm a little iffy on.
Yeah, it gets a little, but, you know.
It's still good.
But one of the things there is that what's really happening is there's like a war between AIs. It's right. It's not like AI versus human.
Right.
It's so.
Yeah. I mean, I think it also kind of goes to this notion of like, let's say in global politics, do we want like a single hegemon? Do we want a single government or political body that has all of the power, that controls everything, and just kind of, you know, we try to make sure that is like the best one, or the right state is the one that has all the power. Like, as long as America dominates everything, then everything will be okay because America's the best, or something like that. Versus this notion of a balance of power, that we actually want a plurality of different types of sovereigns, different types of great nations, and they balance each other, and that is what gives us the least amount of war. And that actually, if you have this one mega entity, that will inevitably lead to civil war, which is the worst type of violent conflict. And there was this period in the 1800s, I believe, in Europe, where it was one of the only examples of a political system that managed to bracket war, and where a war between the European nations in that time was more like a duel, where they did not wage wars of annihilation against each other. And it wasn't, they didn't delegitimize each other. And they still respected each other when they fought the war. And there was limits where they wouldn't try to destroy each other's economies. They would just have the militaries line up and fight each other and wouldn't go past that point. And it was just kind of understood that there's certain issues that there's not an objective answer to who's right and who's wrong. And this is just sort of the only way we can resolve it, because there's not like a higher court or a higher authority that can say you're right and you're wrong. So this is how we're going to decide who wins and who loses, because it is a passionate disagreement and we really care, and we're not just going to like let the other side do what they want. So we're going to fight it out. But that doesn't mean that that other country is evil and that other country should be completely destroyed or the regime should be changed. And this period that we've been in recently of total war goes along with this kind of rhetoric, you know, where when we think about, you know, enemies, like the rhetoric in the United States at like Russia or China or Iran or whatever it is, it's always like, we must destroy them. They must be annihilated. And, you know, even if that means we have to like wipe out their civilian population and destroy their economies, like there's this fundamental incompatibility that leads to this kind of hyperviolence and mega violence, where if we have a system of balance of power and we kind of want there to be these rivalries so we can sort of check each other, that would lead to less war and more peace. And so I think in the spirit of decentralizing AI, there's a similar kind of logic there, which is we don't want there to be one lab and one government that has the singularity AI, the super intelligent AI, and that just controls everything and there's no way to counter it. Like, if we had a decentralization, even to the level of the individual, where I have a super intelligent AI and you have a super intelligent AI and each person has a super intelligent AI that is loyal to that person and serves their interests and their interests alone, rather than having this one mega AI that's aligned to everybody and all of humanity, that it would be better if we could all kind of check each other and keep each other in balance, and that will be the most stable, most peaceful, most prosperous configuration.
Well, I think it would maybe help, you know, such a super intelligent system would help people understand what it takes for them to be happy, which it seems a lot of people, you know, might have that wrong about, like, they might think they need to, like, dominate and control other people or hoard resources or do these other things to be happy, or, like, have, you know, in, you know, so much, you know, just you leave that hoarding resources. But yet, like, that's not, you maybe have different problems, but that alone is not what's going to make you happy. Like,
right. Or also, like, there's this term enlightened self-interest, which I think is interesting, because it's like a lot of people in trying to be self-interested or trying to be, because, like, there's the one argument of, like, go against your self-interest for the higher good.
Sure. That's like a sacrifice.
Yeah, like a sacrifice. Yeah. That's a certain perspective.
Sure.
But even if you're like, I just want to be completely self-interested, you know, I don't buy into that morality.
Yeah, 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 of course, yeah.
You know, I just want to pursue my own interests and what's best for me. That people think something is in their self-interest and then they undermine themselves. And so, like, for example, if you are, if you hoard all the resources and then that causes, like, the population to rise up and kill you, like, it was actually in your self-interest to, like, help your community be healthy and prosperous, even for your own selfish
right.
aims.
Yeah.
You're better off helping other people. And
so these are the kinds of things I feel like a super intelligent AI would help you understand. Right. Like, literally, if every decision, because this is kind of what we're building at Delegance, right? If, you know, world models, if every decision you were thinking about making, or there was something that you wanted and you were going to pursue that, and you could do, like, long-running simulations to achieve that, you might, you know, it could just be like a planning horizon failure. That the reason that the person who hoarded everything and all the people rose up, or, you know, suppose those other people didn't have power, but they all starved and died and got sick, and you're left alone or with like a bigger mess to clean or whatever, like, that's not what you want either. But maybe it's a failure that you didn't think things through enough.
Right.
Like, imagine you could, I feel like this applies to a lot of things. If you could just have an AI think through all these repercussions farther down, second, third, fourth order effects, that it's just literally too expensive for your mental tokens, you know? You could have an AI crunch through that. Then it could come back and be like, well, I know you want this and I know you think it's going to be happy, but let me tell you what happens after and what happens after that. Do you still want it?
Right. That makes a ton of sense. Yeah. You know, if you could have more information about the consequences of your actions and actually understand how things are going to play out, then that would probably bend towards more moral, just behavior, and accountability. Like, I guess I'm on a Socrates kick this day, but another thing that he came up in the in one of the Plato dialogues, the Gorgias, which always I thought was really interesting because it kind of brings this almost to its limit point, where he in a way he was this AI. He was this AI that was helping people understand what is in your interest, what is truly in your self-interest, and what are the consequences of your actions. And through questioning and through dialogue, he would lead people into a state of confusion because they would think that they understood that. And then they would realize, like, wait a minute, I don't know what's going on. And, you know, that's why they ended up killing him eventually. But, but he had this debate where, because they were saying, they were asking about, like, what is the kind of most, what is, like, the peak human excellence, you know? And the sophists would say, well, it's being able to get whatever you want and that kind of stuff. And he would question them and he would say, well, and they would say, and being able to get away with anything you want, like, you can't be punished for things, you know? And that's sort of like the ultimate thing you had the greatest power, and, you know, and he would say, well, I would rather be caught and punished than get away with doing something wrong. And that completely threw them. They're like, what are you talking about? That's crazy. And he starts explaining this whole thing where he's like, it's bad for me if I do something wrong and I'm not held accountable for it. Like, that corrupts me. That makes me have become weaker as a person. You know, I don't learn from my mistakes. I mean, think about like a spoiled child, or, you know, you let the kid just do whatever they want because you don't want to punish them. And then they're going to not be successful in the world, you know? They're going to be in the work environment and they're going to throw a tantrum and everybody's going to be like, what the hell? Like, get rid of this person, you know? Like, you have to learn the lessons of life to be successful.
I mean, just imagine you never experienced pain. Zero pain.
Right.
It'd be impossible. It'd be impossible to navigate life. You could very well die in a lot of situations.
Right.
Not only that, you might stay in situation. You might stay in local minimum way too long.
Yes.
Like, even just being like bored or just feeling stifled or stuck. A lot of times that's because like you've like learned what you need to learn, and you need to go like take some greater challenge or do something. And there's this, you know, we could go on and on. There's all this stuff about like comfort zone expanding, and it's much more enjoyable to expand your comfort zone than just to stay in your comfort zone. But often when you're in your comfort zone, it's not obvious.
And it's hard. It's very hard to choose to leave it, you know, but that's also, life has a way of pushing us out of the comfort zone. And instead of resisting that, which is the natural instinct to recognize that as a gift or an opportunity, or when loss comes or setback or failure comes, to kind of see that as a really beneficial thing. Like in Hinduism, there's the goddess Kali, and she represents like death and destruction. And she actually is depicted in a really scary way with like skulls and all of this stuff. But she's also the divine mother. And I think there's like a deep wisdom in that, and seeing that this thing that we're so afraid of, death and destruction, there's this amazing, compassionate, beneficial aspect where it's clearing out the way for something new to emerge, or it's stripping away things that are false. You know, I mean, that's what people are worried about, the paperclip problem. Like, if you just have endless creation, it's going to lead to the end of the world. Like, you need things to be created and things to be destroyed. And we shouldn't resist that. And also to find, like, to find our power, like, to find our deepest strength and power, you have to be tested. Like, you don't know what you're made of until you're tested, you know? Or if you want to be strong, if you want to have, like, big muscles, you have to, like, have resistance training. You have to suffer.
You have to lift until failure.
You have to lift until failure, you know? And you have to push against what doesn't feel good, to actually feel how strong you are, you know? Or it reminds me in Dune, you know, like when he puts the hand in the box and it's like pain, but then it awakens in him this like sleeping giant, this sleeping thing that's not going to just wake up for anything, you know? It's only going to get activated when you're pushed to the absolute limit of what you think you can endure. And then you find something in yourself that you didn't even know was there.
I love it.
So somehow this is where we ended up.
Yeah.
Opus 4.8 and
try out the
orchestration.
Try out the dynamic workflows.
Yeah. And find that power in yourself. See what you can create with AI. The only limit is what you're able to name. And
the only thing that matters these days is just willingness. If you want to accomplish something, all you have to do is be willing to put in the time and effort to work with AI to figure out how you can make that happen.
Yeah. So have fun. We certainly are.
Yeah.
And we'll see you again for the next time.
See you next time.